In The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown popularized a theory about the origin of the New Testament as a collection of writings that dates back to at least the 1930s. The theory goes that it was not until the 4th century AD, the late 300s, that any decisions were made about what was to be included in the New Testament. Until then, the suggestion is, there were many different Gospels and many different letters, as well as a fair few books like Revelation, what are called apocalypses. It was only church councils in the late 4th century that decided what should be in and which out. And they supposedly decided in such a way as to exclude books that they considered unorthodox, especially, and here's the crux, those books that stressed the importance of women in the church, or refused to accept that sex was evil. So, hence, a malign patriarchy is responsible for the contents of the present New Testament, and without this malign patriarchy, we might have had a completely different set of books, all about sexual freedom. There's actually some truth amongst the falsehoods here. It is true that it was only towards the end of the 4th century that councils and bishops gave rulings on the contents of the New Testament. And true also that they excluded some books on the grounds that they were Gnostic. Gnosticism was a strange hybrid type of religion, stressing direct knowledge of God for those who had been specially illuminated. But it could go either way on the question of sex. Some Gnostic texts are far more virulently tight-laced and anti-sex than the most ascetic of the church's theologians, which is saying something, which you certainly wouldn't guess from reading Dan Brown. But to assert that the church of the 4th century selected tendentiously the books of which they approved is a travesty. The very first document that lists exactly the books that were to be in what we now recognise as the New Testament to the exclusion of all others is a letter sent round to the churches under his jurisdiction by Athanasius, Bishop of Alexandria, in 367 AD. All that this letter does is to list the books on which the church had, for the most part, already agreed. The four Gospels, the major letters of St. Paul, the first letters of Peter and John, the Acts of the Apostles. And in fact, we already knew all this, and so did the churches to which Athanasius was writing, since these are the books that Christian writers had been quoting since at least the middle of the 2nd century. The only place where writers of the 4th century offer what could be called a ruling is at the fringes of the collection, where we again already knew there was some dissension. Should the New Testament include the very short 2nd and 3rd letters of John? Should the book of Revelation really be part of the Bible? People still ask that. What about a few books that early Christians were quite keen on, such as the long and rambling apocalypse called The Shepherd? This last actually appears alongside the New Testament books in the great Codex Sinaiticus, now in the British Library, which is also from the 4th century. It is on such matters that Athanasius offers a ruling. Only the books we still recognise as the New Testament are to be included, and Revelation gets in. But there's no suggestion that he is selecting from a larger body of possible candidates. He's simply endorsing what was already pretty much settled. Already in the 2nd century, the Gospels we know today were universally accepted in the Church. And other Gospels, such as the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, whose publication some years ago caused quite the stir, were known only to a few. Almost all such contested Gospels are much later than the ones in our New Testament, and have little claim to any real contact with Jesus. The Gospel of Judas, too, was in all the papers a few years ago after it was published in the National Geographic in 2007. It contains the line put in the mouth of Jesus, "You shall crucify the man who clothes me." This is a typically Gnostic formulation, implying that Jesus was not really crucified, but only appeared to be. A notion that, fascinatingly, became part of Muslim belief about the crucifixion. But there's no evidence that this gospel was widely known of within the church, still less that anyone ever suppressed it. It simply vanished until its modern rediscovery, and only a complex conspiracy theory will establish that the fathers of the church cancelled it. The answer to the question, who chose the four gospels, is that no one did. They established themselves in the church, being much older than any rival accounts of Jesus' life. And by the mid-second century, people quoted them almost to the exclusion of any other sources for Jesus' life and ministry. They had become scripture, we might say, because they had always been there. Even attempts like that of early Christian theologian Tatian, who hankered after a harmony and consistency of the Gospels, were largely resisted. They were not open to negotiation. Much the same applies to the letters of St. Paul. The mistake in the Dan Brown theory is as much a logical as a historical one. It fails to draw a crucial distinction between a belief that certain books at least should definitely be in the New Testament and a belief that certain books at most should be in it. By the end of the second century, practically everyone agreed that the Gospels, Acts, and the main letters were definitely in, that these books, as an absolute minimum, were of the canon, as Christians had it, that is, they belonged to the official Bible. But there was as yet no sense that this Bible was absolutely closed. No one had yet decided that the books I've mentioned were the only books to be in it, and there were indeed other candidates for membership. These included some candidates that did eventually get in, such as Revelation, and some that in the end didn't, such as the Shepherd. It's this issue, the books on the margins of the Bible, that the 4th century rulings were about, not the great solid core of the New Testament. That had been decided long ago. If we think back to the formation of the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, a very similar picture emerges for the New Testament. There was the Torah, which no one had ever had doubts about, plus a good many historical, prophetic, wisdom, and poetic books that may not have had the same status as the Torah, but were definitely still in. But then there was a penumbra, mainly consisting of the books we call the Apocrypha. Some Jews, at least for a time, and eventually almost all Christians, did come to accept them as part of the Bible. Others did not. Jewish sources discuss a few books in that category, particularly the book called The Wisdom of Jesus, Son of Sirah, a great wisdom text from the 2nd century BC, which the Church came to revere greatly under the title Ecclesiasticus. This is not to be confused with Ecclesiastes. The Jewish rabbis come down against it on the basis that it was written too recently to be in the Bible. But there are no Jewish sources that discuss whether Genesis or other books from the Torah should be in the Bible. Genesis was never selected from a wider set of possibilities. It got in under its own steam. Exactly how, we don't know. There's just one book discovered in modern times that may have some claim to be read alongside the New Testament if we want to know more about Jesus. This is the Gospel of Thomas. This was found, along with other texts, mostly Gnostic, at the site of Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945. It's a collection of sayings, and a few of them might pass muster for authenticity as being real sayings of Jesus. For example, "When you know yourselves, then you will be known, and you will know that you are sons of the living Father. But if you do not know yourselves, then you are in poverty, and you yourselves are the poverty." There are scholars who think the Gospel of Thomas might be as old as the New Testament Gospels, or at least as old as the latest of them, John. A few sayings of Jesus quoted by early Christian writers don't actually occur in the New Testament, but have turned up in Thomas. And Origen, the 3rd century writer I quoted on the creation story, was certainly aware of its existence. Finds like the ones at Nag Hammadi sometimes lead people to ask whether we should reassess the contents of the Bible and put other books in, and possibly take some others out too. I think this approach fundamentally misunderstands the process that led to the making of the Bible in the first place. The case for the books that are in it really rests on the grounds that the Church has always acknowledged them, not that they are either very early or very good. In fact, the religious quality of what is in our New Testament is indeed very high, while some of the works that weren't included are poor. But I don't think that the letter of Jude, say, is necessarily better in any absolute sense than some sections of Thomas. It's just that the Bible is a given, as it was from the beginning, a kind of self-selecting collection of books. It's not very tidy. People have always had doubts about its outer fringes, but the central core is a fixture. One book that was too late to make it into the New Testament, since it comes from the end of the 2nd century, is the Proto-Gospel of James. This was much loved in the early church, and exists in at least 100 different Greek manuscripts. It's the source of a number of features in the Nativity story, as most people today would know it and will have celebrated it last week. Joseph as an old man who had been married before, for instance Mary riding a donkey, the ox and the ass in the stable, and the stable being located in a cave, which is the normal understanding in the Eastern Orthodox churches. Many people are surprised to learn that none of these details is in the New Testament, only in the Proto-Gospel of James. So, although we may nowadays think of the New Testament as a fixed, immovable object, in truth, as is so often the case, on closer inspection, we detect a certain fuzziness around its illustrious edges.